From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Resting Place by Oliver LaFarge. The possibility that Dr. Hillebrand was developing kleptomania caused a good deal of pleasure among his younger colleagues, that is, the entire personnel of the Department of Anthropology, including its director, Walter Klibben. It was not that anybody really disliked the old boy. That would have been hard to do, for he was cooperative and gentle, and his humor was mild. He was perhaps the greatest living authority on Southwestern archaeology, and broadly learned in the general science of anthropology, and he was a man who delighted in the success of others. Dr. Hillebrand was the last surviving member of a group of men who had made the Department of Anthropology famous in the earlier part of the 20th century. His ideas were old-fashioned, to Walter Klibben, who at 40 was very much the young-comer, and to the men he had gathered about him. Dr. Hillebrand's presence, clothed with authority, was as incongruous as that of a small, mild brontosaurus would be in a modern farmyard. On the other hand, no one living had a finer archaeological technique. Added to this was a curious intuition, which caused them to dig in unexpected places and come up with striking finds. The king of thing that delights donors and trustees, such as the largest unbroken Mesa Verde black-on-white jar known up to that time, the famous Bitabito cache of turquoise and shell objects, discovered 2 years before and not yet on exhibition, and only the previous year, the mural decorations at Painted Mask Ruin, the mural of which, as yet only a small part had been uncovered, compared favorably with the murals found at Awatovi in Kaiwaika'a by the Peabody Museum, but was several centuries older. Moreover, in the part already exposed, there was an identifiable Kachina mask, unique and conclusive evidence that the Kachina cult dated back to long before the white man came. This meant, Dr. Klibben foresaw gloomily, that once again all available funds for publication would be tied up by the old coot's material. The trustees loved him. Several years ago he had reached the age of retirement, and they had waived the usual limitation in his case. He was curator of the museum, a position only slightly less important than that of director, and he occupied the Kleinman chair in American archaeology. This was an endowed position, paying several thousand a year more than Klibben's own professorship. Dr. Hillebrand's occupancy of these positions, on top of his near monopoly of publication money, was the rub. He blocked everything. If only the old relic would become emeritus, the younger men could move up. Klibben had it all worked out. There would be the Kleinman chair for himself, and MacDonald could accede to his professorship. He would leave Steinberg an associate, but make him curator. Thus Steinberg and MacDonald would have it in mind that the curatorship always might be transferred to MacDonald as the man with senior status, which would keep them both on their toes. At least one assistant professor could, in due course, be made an associate, and young George Franklin, Klibben's own prize student, could be promoted from instructor to assistant. It all fitted together and reinforced his own position. Then, given free access to funds for monographs and papers, but Dr. Hillebrand showed no signs of retiring. It was not that he needed the money from his two positions. He was a bachelor and something of an aesthetic. Much of his salary he put into his own expeditions. He loved to teach, he said, and his students liked him. He loved his museum. In fact, he was daffy about it, pottering around in it until late at night. Well, Let him retire. He could still teach a course or two if he wanted. He could still potter. But Clibborn could run his department as he wished, as it ought to be run. Since there seemed no hope that the old man would give out physically in the near future, Clibborn had begun looking for symptoms of mental failure. There was, for instance, the illogical way in which Dr. Hillebrand often decided just where to run a trench or dig a post hole. As Steinberg once remarked, it was as if he were guided by a Ouija board. Unfortunately, this eccentricity produced splendid results. Then, sometimes, Hillebrand would say to his students, "Now, let us imagine," and proceed to indulge in surprising reconstructions of the daily life and religion of the ancient cliff dwellers, going far beyond the available evidence. The director had put Franklin onto that because the young man had worked on Hopi and Zuni ceremonials. Franklin reported that the old boy always made it clear that these reconstructions were not science, and further, Franklin said that they were probably shrewd and had given him some helpful new insights into aspects of the modern Indian's religion. The possibility of kleptomania was something else again. The evidence, insufficient so far, concerned the rich Bitabitokash, which Dr. Hillebrand himself was enumerating, cataloguing, and describing, mostly evenings when the museum was closed. He was the only one who knew exactly how many objects had been in the find, but it did look as if some of it might now be missing. There was also what the night watchman thought he had seen. And then there was that one turquoise bead, but no proof it had come from that source, of course, that MacDonald had found on the floor near the cast of the Quirigua Stella, just inside the entrance of the museum. The thefts, if there had been any, had taken place in April and early May, when everyone was thinking of the end of the college year and the summer's field trips. A short time later, and quite by accident, Clibborn learned from an associate professor of ornithology that old Hildebrand had obtained from him a number of feathers, which he said he wanted for repairing his collection of Kachina dolls. Among them were parrot and macaw feathers, and the fluffy feathers from the breast of an eagle. Clibborn's field was not the American Southwest, but any American anthropologist would have been able to draw an obvious conclusion. Turquoise, shell, and feathers of those sorts were components of ritual offerings among the modern Hopis and Zunis, and possibly their ancestors, whose remains Dr. Hillebrand had carried on his life work. Dr. Clibborn began to suspect, or hope, that the old man was succumbing to a mental weakness far more serious than would be evidenced by the mere stealing of a few bits of turquoise and shell. The director made tactful inquiries at the genetics field laboratory to see if the old man had been seeking corn pollen, another component of the ritual offerings, and found that there the question of the evolution of Zea Mais in the Southwest was related to the larger and much vexed question of the origin and domestication of that important New World plant, so interesting to archaeologists, botanists, and geneticists. Dr. Hillebrand had been collecting specimens of ancient corn from archaeological sites for a long time, ears, cobs, and grains extending over two millenniums or more, and other parts of the plant, including some fragments of tassels. It was, Clibborn thought, the kind of niggling little detail you would expect to find Hillebrand spending good time on. Dr. Hillebrand had been turning his specimens over to the plant and hereditary boys, who were delighted to have them. They, in turn, had followed this up by obtaining, for comparison, seed of modern Pueblo Indians, Navajo, and Hopi corn, and planting it. It was natural enough, then, that from time to time, Dr. Hillebrand should take specimens of seeds and pollen home to study on his own. It might be clear as day to Clibborn that the old boy had gone gaga to the point of making ritual offerings to the gods of the cliff dwellings. He still had nothing that would convince a strongly pro-Hillebrand Board of Trustees. Even so, the situation was hopeful. Clibborn suggested to the night watchman that, out of concern for Professor Hildebrand's health, he keep a special eye on the professor's after-hours behaviors in the museum. Come June, he would arrange for Franklin, with his southwestern interest. Franklin was a logical choice, to go along on Hildebrand's expeditions and see what he could see. Franklin took the assignment willingly, by no means unaware of the possible advantages to himself should the old man be retired. The archaeologist accepted this addition to his staff with equanimity. He remarked that Franklin's knowledge of Pueblo daily life would be helpful in interpreting what might be uncovered, while a better grounding in southwestern prehistory would add depth to the young man's ethnographic perceptions. Right after commencement, they set out for the Navajo country of Arizona, accompanied by 2 undergraduate and 4 graduate students. At Farmington in New Mexico, they picked up the university's truck and station wagon, and Hildebrand's own field car, a Model A Ford as archaic as its owner. In view of the man's income, Franklin thought, his hanging on to the thing was more than one oddity, an item that could be added to many others to help prove Klibben's case. At Farmington, too, they took on a cook and general helper. Dr. Hildebrand's work was generously financed, quite apart from what went into it from his own earnings. The party bounced over the horrifying road past the Four Corners and around the north end of the beautiful mountain, into the Chinle Valley, then southward and westward, until, after having taken a day and a half to drive about 200 miles, they reached the cliffs against which stood Painted Mask Ruin. The principal aim of the current summer's work was to excavate the decorated kiva in detail, test another kiva, and make further standard excavations in the ruin as a whole. By the end of a week, the work was going nicely. Dr. Hildebrand put Franklin as a senior scientist under him in charge of the work in the painted kiva. Franklin knew perfectly well that he was deficient in the required techniques. He would, in fact, be dependent upon his first assistant, Philip Fleming, who was just short of his Ph.D. Fleming had worked in that kiva the previous season, had spent 3 earlier seasons with Dr. Hildebrand, and was regarded by him as the most promising of the many who had worked under him. There was real affection between the two men. 2 of the other graduate students were well qualified to run a simple dig for themselves. One was put in charge of the untouched second kiva, the other of a trench cutting into the general mass of the ruin from the north. Franklin felt uncomfortably supernumerary, but he recognized that that was an advantage in pursuing his main purpose of keeping a close watch on the expedition's director. After supper on the evening of the 8th day, Dr. Hildebrand announced rather shyly that he would be gone for about 4 days, to follow an old custom you all know about. The younger man smiled. Franklin kept a blank face to cover his quickened interest. This was a famous or notorious eccentricity of the old man's, and one in which Drs. Klibben, McDonnell, and the rest put great hope. Every year, early in the season, Dr. Hildebrand went alone to a ruin he had excavated early in his career. There was some uncertainty as to just where the ruin was. It was believed to be one known to the Navajos as Sikaikin. No one knew what he had there, or what he did there. He said he found the surroundings and the solitude invaluable for thinking out the task in hand. It was usually not long after his return from it that he would announce his decision to dig in such and such a spot and proceed to uncover the painted kiva or the kettle cave fetishes or the Kin Hatososi blanket or some other notable find. If Franklin could slip away in the station wagon and follow the old man, he might get just the information he wanted. So far, Dr. Hildebrand's activities on the expedition had evidenced nothing but his great competence. If the old man ever performed mad antique rites with stolen specimens, it would be at his secret place of meditation. Perhaps he got up and danced to the ancient gods. One might be able to sneak a photo. Dr. Hildebrand said, "I shan't be gone long. Meantime, of course, Dr. Franklin will be in charge." He turned directly to his junior. "George, there are several things on which you must keep a close watch. If you will look at these diagrams, and you too, Phil." Franklin and Fleming sat down beside him. Dr. Hildebrand expounded. Whether the ancient devil had done it intentionally or not, Franklin saw that he was neatly hooked. In the face of the delicacy and the probable outcome of the next few days' work, he could not possibly make an excuse for absenting himself when the head of the expedition was also absent. Dr. Hillebrand took off early the next morning in his throbbing Model A. He carried with him a Spartan minimum of food and bedding. It was good to be alone once more in the long-loved reaches of the Navajo country. The car drove well. He still used it because, short of a Jeep, nothing newer had the clearance to take him where he wanted to go. He drove slowly, for he was at the age when knowledge and skill must replace strength, and getting stuck would be serious. When he was 50, he reflected, he would have reached T's Hatsosi Canyon from this year's camp in under 4 hours. When he was 30, if it had been possible then to travel this country in a car, he would have made even greater speed, and as like as not ended by getting lost. He reached the open farming area outside the place where T Hatsosi sliced into the great mesa to the south. There was nearly twice as many hogans to be seen as when he had first come here. Several of them were square and equipped with windows, and by some of them cars were parked. Everything was changing, but these were good people still, although not as genial and hospitable as their grandparents had been when he first packed in. He entered the narrow mouth of T's Hatsosi Canyon in the late afternoon, and by the exercise of consummate skill drove some 4 miles up it. At that point it was somewhat wider than elsewhere, slightly under 200 feet across at the bottom. The heavy grazing that had so damaged all the Navajos' land had had some effect here. There was less grass than there used to be, but then, he reflected, he had no horses to pasture, and the bed of the wash was more deeply eroded, and here and there sharp gullies led into it from the sides. Still the cottonwoods grew between the occasional stream and the high, warm, golden, buff cliffs. Except at noon, there was shade, and the quality of privacy, almost of secrecy, remained. In the west wall was the wide strip of white rock from which the little ruin took its name. Sikai Kin, leading the eye to the long ledge above which the cliff arched like a scallop shell, and upon which stood the ancient habitations. The lip of the ledge was about 20 feet above the level of the canyon, and approachable by a talus slope that was not too hard to negotiate. Some small evergreens grew at the corners of the ledge. From the ground, the settlement did not seem as if it had been empty for centuries, but rather as if its occupants at the moment happened not to be visible. The small black rectangles of doorways and 3 tiny squares of windows made him feel as they had done over 40 years ago, as if the little settlement were watching him. South of the far end of the ledge and at the level of the canyon floor was the spring. Water seeped richly through a crack in the rock a few feet above the ground and flowed down over rock to form a pool at the base. The wet, golden-brown stone glistened. Small water growths clung to the crevices. In the pool itself there was cress and a rounded moss and grass rich enough to make a few feet of turf. Here Dr. Hillebrand deposited his bedroll and his food. He estimated that he had better than 2 hours of daylight left. He cut himself a supply of firewood. Then he took a package out of his coffee pot. The package was wrapped in an old piece of buckskin. With this in hand, he climbed up the slope to the ruin. The sense of peace had begun once he was out of sight of the camp at Painted Mask Ruin. It had grown when he entered T Hatsosi Canyon. It had become stronger when he stepped out of the car and glimpsed through the cottonwoods his little village with its 14 rooms. By the spring, it had become stronger yet and mixed with the nostalgia of past times that was sweetly painful, like a memory of an old and good lost love. These feelings were set aside as he addressed himself to the task of climbing, which was not entirely simple. Then they returned fourfold when he was in the ruin. Here he had worked alone, a green young man with a shiny new doctor's degree, a boy man not unlike young Fleming. Here he had discovered what it was like to step into a room that still had its roof intact and see the marks of the smoke from the household fire, the loom ties still in place, in the ceiling and floor, the broken cooking pot still in the corner. He paid his respects to that chamber, room 4B, stood in the small open central area, then went to the roofless irregular oval of the kiva. All by himself, he had dug it out. Could Dr. Franklin have been there spying unseen, he would have been most happy. From under a stone that appeared firmly embedded in the clay footing, Dr. Hillebrand took an ancient, crude stone pipe fitted with a recent willow stem. He filled it with tobacco, performed curious motions as he lit it, and puffed smoke in the six directions. Then he climbed out of the kiva on the inner side and went behind the double rows of habitations, to the darker area under the convex curve of the wall at the back of the cave, the floor which was a mixture of earth and rubbish. Two smallish rounded stones, about 3 feet apart, inconspicuously marked the place. Sitting by it on a convenient ledge of rock, he puffed at the pipe again. Then he opened the buckskin package and proceeded to make an offering of ancient turquoise beads, white and red shell, black stone feathers, and down corn pollen. Sitting back comfortably, he said, "Well, here I am again." The answer did not come from the ground in which the bones of the speaker reposed, but from a point in space as if he were sitting opposite Dr. Hillebrand. "Welcome, old friend. Thank you for the gifts. This smell is pleasing to us all." "I don't know whether I can bring you any more," the archaeologist said. "I can buy new things, of course, but getting the old ones is becoming difficult. They are watching me." "It is not necessary," the voice answered. "We are rich in the spirits of things such as these, and our grandchildren on earth still offer them to us. It has been rather for your benefit that I've had you bring them, and I think that that training has served its purpose." "You relieve me," then with a note of anxiety. "That doesn't mean that I have to stop visiting you?" "Not at all. And by the way, there is a very handsome jar with a quantity of beans of an early variety in it where you are digging now. It was left behind by accident when the people before the ones who built the painted kiva moved out. It belonged to a woman called Bluebird Tailfeather. Her small child ran off and was lost just as they were moving, and by the time she found them, the war chief was impatient. However, we can come back to that later. I can see that you have something on your mind." "I'm lonely," Dr. Hillebrand said simply. "My real friends are all gone. There are a lot of people I get on nicely with, but no one left I love. That is, above the ground. And you are the only one below the ground I seem to be able to reach. I'd like to take your remains back with me, and then we could talk again." "I would not like that." "Then of course I won't." "I was sure of that. Your country is strange to me, and traveling back and forth would be a lot of effort. What I saw that time I visited you was alien to me. It would be to you, too, I think. It won't be long. I believe before I am relieved of attachment to my bones entirely, but if you move them now, it would be annoying. You take that burial you carried home 10 years ago, old Rabbit Stick. He says you treat him well and have given him the smell of ceremonial jewels whenever you could, but sometimes he arrives quite worn out from his journey." "Rabbit Stick," Dr. Hillebrand mused. "I wondered if there was not someone there. He has never spoken to me." "He couldn't. He was just an ordinary Reed Clan man. But he is grateful to you for the offerings, because they have given him the strength he needed. As you know, I can speak with you because I was the sun's forehead, and there was the good luck that you were thinking and feeling in the right way when you approached me. But tell me, don't the young men who learn from you keep you company?" "Yes. There is one now who is like a son to me, but then they have learned and they go away. The men in between, who have become chiefs, you might say, in my department, have no use for me. They want to make me emeritus, that is, put me on a pension, take over my authority and my rewards, and set me where I could give advice and they could ignore it. They have new ways, and they despise mine. So now they're watching me. They have sent a young man out this time just to watch me. They call him a student of the ways of your grandchildren. He spent 6 weeks at Zuni once, and when even he could see that the people didn't like him, he went and put in the rest of the summer at Orabi." "New Orabi or Old Orabi?" the son's forehead asked. "New Orabi." The chief snorted. So, having also read some books, he thinks he is an ethnographer, only he calls himself a cultural anthropologist, and he is out here to try to find proof that my mind is failing. He smiled. They'd certainly think so if they saw me sitting here talking to empty air. The son's forehead chuckled. They certainly would. They wouldn't be able to hear me, you know. Then his voice became serious again. That always happens, I think. It happened to me. They wanted to do things differently. When I had at last come to the point at which an old man talked to me, I reached it in old age, not young as you did. They could not take my title, but they wanted to handle my duties for me, bring me enough food to live on, hear my advice, and not listen to it. Struggling against them became wearying and distasteful, so finally I decided to go under. At the age I reached, about your age, it is easy to do. And now you say that you are about to be detached from your bones entirely? You are reaching the next stage? Let us say that I begin to hope. Our life is beautiful, but for 100 years or so now, I have been longing for the next, and I begin to hope. How does it happen? Or is it wrong for me to know? You may know. You are good, and you keep your secrets, as our wise men always did. You will see a man who has come, young, handsome, and full of light. When we dance, he dances with great beauty. His singing is beautiful, and you feel as if it were creating life. Then one time when the Kachinas themselves are dancing before us, not masks, you understand, the Kachinas themselves, you can't find him among the watchers. Then you seem to recognize him, there among the sacred people, dancing like them. Then you think that the next time our grandchildren on the earth put on the masks and dance, that one, whom you knew as a spirit striving to purify himself, who used to tell you about his days on earth, will be there. With his own eyes he will see our grandchildren and bless them. The chief's voice trailed off as though the longing for what he was describing deprived him of words. To see the Kachinas themselves dancing, Dr. Hillebrand mused. Not the masks, but what the masks stand for. That would keep me happy for centuries. But then, I could not join your people. I was never initiated. I'd be plain silly trying to dance with them. It's not for me. For over 40 years I have been initiating you, the son's forehead said. As for dancing, you will no longer be in that old body. You will not be dancing with those fragile rheumatic bones. There is room for you in our country. Why don't you come over? Just lie down in that crevice back there and make up your mind. You know, Dr. Hillebrand said, I think I will. Both the Kleinman professor of American archaeology and the spirit who once had been the sun's forehead for the settlements in the neighborhood of Tis Hatzosi were thoroughly unworldly. It had not occurred to either of them that within 6 days after Dr. Hillebrand had left camp, Dr. George Franklin would organize a search for him, and 4 days later his body would be found where he had died of apparently heart failure. Above all, it had not occurred to them that his body would be taken home and buried with proper pomp and ceremony in the appropriate cemetery. But Philip Fleming, close to tears, resolutely overlooked the scattering of turquoise and shells in the rubbish between the crevice and the kiva. Dr. Hillebrand found himself among people as alien to him as they had been to the sun's forehead. They seemed to be gaunt from the total lack of offerings and the means by which they should purify and advance themselves to where they could leave this life for the next, which he believed to be the final one, were confused. He realized what his spirit was burdened with much dross, and that it would be a long time before he would gather the strength to attempt a journey to the country of his friend. His portrait, an academic gown and hood, was painted posthumously and hung in the entrance of the museum to one side of the stela from Quiqua and facing the reproduction of the famous painted Kiva mural. Dr. Klibben adroitly handled the promotions and emoluments that fell under his control. Philip Fleming won his Ph.D. with honor and was promptly offered a splendid position at Harvard, moved by he knew not what drive, and following one or two other actions he had performed to his own surprise, Fleming went to Dr. Hillebrand's grave for a gesture of respect. and thanks. It had seemed to him inappropriate to bring any flowers. Instead, as he sat by the grave with small motions of his hand, he sprinkled over it some bits of turquoise and shell he had held out from a necklace he had unearthed, and followed them with a pinch of pollen given him by a Navajo. Suddenly his face registered utter astonishment, then careful listening. The following season, Fleming returned to Painted Mask Ruin by agreement with Dr. Klibben, who was delighted to get his department entirely out of Southwestern archaeology. There, he ran a trench that led right into a magnificent polychrome pot containing a store of beans of high botanical interest. Within a few years, he stopped visiting the grave, but he was sentimentalist enough to make a pilgrimage all alone to Sky Kin at the beginning of each field season. It was jokingly said among his confreres that there he communed with the spirit of old Hildebrand. Certainly he seemed to have inherited that legendary figure's gift for making spectacular finds.